Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about phosphate biochemistry. So biochemistry is obviously the chemistry of light. Phosphate is sort of very, very important for a number of things. So often they show cells, life doing things, and then cells doing things, and it's as if it's being computer programmed. People sort of feel that if you can do a flash animation of it or an animation of it, the magic of computers is sort of like the magic, things magically move. Really what you're watching is a motion response to a chemical reaction, a phosphate chemical reaction. So if I just have the series of proteins sitting in water, they'll sit there like, you know, statues. But if I add some phosphate chemicals to it, the proteins will react with the phosphate chemicals and begin to move in coordination. And particularly the chemical, the phosphate chemical it reacts with is something called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Now, this chemical links into the protein receptors, and what it does is it locks in. It has some negative charges in the phosphate. That pulls negative charges around the molecule. It changes shape, and in doing so, it ejects a phosphate ion out there, three phosphate ions. And so there's a sort of like a battery and a release of a chemical. Now, normal batteries actually do release chemicals when they're operating. So your A cell or AAA or AA cell battery is corroding from the inside and releasing hydrogen. So each electron which goes around your lamp goes in to free hydrogen from an acid, and it's got the electron from the acid, and the electron is pulled out from the metal. So metal is basically electron drenched crystal. So that crystal becomes ions. The electrons then hop onto the hydrogen of the acid and get released. So your little hydrogen, your A cell battery, if you put it under water and ran it, you'd get little bubbles of hydrogen. And yes, you'd be able to pick that hydrogen up and explode it. And so therefore, that gives you an idea that there's a lot of energy stored in the battery, and it uses only a tiny fraction of it to run your iPod or whatever it is to go across. Now, this is very similar to a living cell. So it's got all sorts of proteins are doing everything. Everything's moving inside the cell, and it moves. And rather than have the battery is sort of like an atmosphere of batteries, and batteries float onto yourself, and you have a receptor for charged batteries, and charged batteries land on you. They do a bit of work. They actually don't physically move charge. They polarize charge. They're polarization batteries, and they do the work and the energy. Is they go from a high energy state with three phosphates to a low energy state with two phosphates. So it's this magic juice pops around the place, adenosine triphosphate. So let's look at adenosine molecule. Now, I'm really struggling to memorize some of it coming off the back of my head. I have little things in my head. So there's the adenine base that you have in your DNA. Adenine, thymine, guanine, and cysteine. These are all things. The adenine and guanine, I think it is, are the double ring nitrogenous bases. That is, They've got two rings, a ring of five, a ring of six, sharing two, and then nitrogenous bases. That means that in the rings, so that's a five and six, there's two in the five and two in the six. Two in the five are either side of the apex, and in the six, they obviously can't be symmetric. So one's on the bottom apex of the hexagon, and one's on the back door of that hexagon going across. I've got a picture of it in my head. Now, I've got to really get in my head, because I've got caffeine and the base in my head. It's all mixed up. So this thing's attached to that. There's an oxygen, possibly another nitrogen. So I think adenosine has got three binding sites. Three or two binding sites. It's either three or two hydrogen binding sites for DNA. What we're going to talk about is moving back to the left of the molecule. We've got on the left, we've got the five ring, and on the right, we've got the six ring. So when I say left and right, you unfortunately have to go into the whiteboard of my own brain. On the bottom left-hand side, nitrogen is a... I'm just trying to think, what do you call sugar, sucrose, ribose? Yeah, deoxyribose. It's a ribose. It's an oxyribose. It's a ribose sugar, a five-ring sugar, and hooked onto that is a docking station for your phosphates. And the phosphates are the four oxygens and a phosphorus in the center. So the I can imagine the phosphorus orbitals has enough room for the oxygens. And the important thing to note is that you need quantum mechanics to understand how the electron can actually sink into the middle of this thing. So this is highly positive nucleuses with the a sort of shell of electrons on the outside and a sort of void for the electrons to go into. So this can be it's an ion, P4 double minus. It's something which can actually quite happily take two electrons sucked into the center. Now, it's a polyatomic ion, so each oxygen, which can normally take two, O2 minus, this is no big deal for it. There's a whole lot of electronegativity all bundled up in there. Now, the interesting thing is that phosphorus is not as electronegative as oxygen. So it's sort of an interesting molecule to look around. And the electronegativity means that if you draw the potential energy diagram for it, that is a Coulombic potential energy diagram. Now, bottom line, if you draw a Coulombic potential energy diagram, that is based on a model of point charges. The point charge is the energy between two points in space, as if there are point charges, and they're not. But you can sort of modify it and think about it. So you get through these paradoxes and contradictions that sort of, well, they keep me awake at night. Other people are off dreaming about their bank balances and people leaving them and what's said at their work. I'm sort of off at night dreaming at, oh, how can you draw a potential energy diagram? And you really technically can't really draw a two-dimensional Coulombic potential energy diagram, because we're leaving into a much higher dimension than the two dimensions that you're drawing there. But you can do a simulation of it, an adjustment of it, such it looks there. Now, it looks as though that you can draw an electron energy level inside that you can actually bind more electrons than the charge, which is a thing. So you have something which can actually hold negative charges as the phosphates. And the phosphates have this thing called electron affinity, not electron negativity, I may have said that before, electron affinity. Electron affinity is to hold greater than its charge. So two protons can hold three electrons, and generally a number of protons can hold n or n plus two number of electrons. In general, two, and a polyatomic one can actually easily hold up to two. So you got your sulfuric acid, SO4 double minus, can act as a little thing which can actually eat electrons, and it eats electrons so much that you can see an acid as something which eats electrons a lot. If you put it into water, it likes to eat electrons, and eating an electron from water liberates an H plus. So there's two ways of, there's various ways of looking at an acid. There's the Arrhenius, Lowry Brownstead, and Lewis. The Lewis just looks at who's eating electrons, and the H plus is a side effect. The Arrhenius is looking at H plus, and the Lowry Brownstead, I can't pronounce it, but that looks at acid base as a dynamic theme. So an acid plus a base goes to an acid plus a base. It's at equilibrium. So Lowry Brownstead allows you to see that as you add an acid to a base, it gives you an equilibrium. It's more to get in there. But the sort of beauty of this is that you can actually stack. I don't know why there's three. I suppose you could do four, an infinite number of phosphates onto each other, and each would be polarized and suck out electrons. They would draw electrons to it. And so if you have something like adenine triphosphate, you've got adenosine. So adenosine is this, so adenine is the base, adenosine is the base plus the ribose sugar added onto it. And the ribose sugar has just got the function of phosphate sticks to it. So your phosphate sticks to it and draws electrons through the ribose out of your adenosine. So this is sort of like, it is a battery, a negative charge. The battery is negative and goes positive, and the positive side's the other side, polarization. And the base actually goes up. I can't visualize how it would stick, but it slots into various proteins. And when it slots into a protein, it can slot into the protein. And when the protein moves, part of the protein moving, it liberates the phosphate. Now, this is sort of interesting for a number of mechanical things as well, because you have conservation of angular momentum. You've got all these physical things. You've got linear momentum of doing these things. So these things can't, if they move, the throwing off of lighter things is a sort of a vibrational cooling. You increase the entropy of it, so you've got a low entropy ATP, it's a higher entropy ADP, diphosphate, and the phosphate free, that's a higher entropy thing. So there's the entropy, conservation of momentum, and charge all happening there at the moment. And so essentially it's a little machine which takes protein has got a series of things it takes on: a adenosine triphosphate (ATP). It interacts or it docks with them. Then, as it moves, the electric charge moves, and the electric charge inside. So it's not a circuit; more polarization. It moves, and as it moves, it releases a phosphate. It goes to diphosphate, but then it also releases the bond as well, as the diphosphate doesn't stick as well. It's a discharge battery. It's no longer interested in it. So it's almost as so you've got negative and positive charges sucking in the battery, and when the battery is used, it just floats out. Now, this is all very good, but you've got to say, well, and now I have this problem of, do I really believe that I now have a lot of ADP, and so the ADP, does the ADP float all the way back to the mitochondria? So the mitochondria is your powerhouse, which is making ATP, but it also makes other things, and the other thing it makes is phosphocreatine. Now, this molecule is a very interesting molecule. So you've got the protein, your ATP. The ATP and protein is a story to go across. But if you move your attention away to what happens afterwards, the molecule's moved, you've got a phosphate ion floating out. So phosphate ion and a ADP diphosphate around, and you've got to stick that together. Now, you could imagine a process of a sort of a big molecule, a big machine, getting the ATP, ADP, and sticking the phosphate on. It must happen. But there's an intermediary called phosphocreatine. And this is a molecule which has got a carbon with three nitrogens around it. So a central carbon, three nitrogens, must have a hydrogen to lock it off, I suppose. Got to think about it. One of the nitrogens has got a water on it, so it's highly water-soluble and charge-oriented. And one of the carbons attaches to a phosphate. It can attach to a phosphate. And what this does is this, this molecule, when it hasn't got the phosphates on it, mops up all the phosphate ions. So there's got to be some sort of catalyst which transports the phosphate ions and sticks it to it. So it adds, the energy is added to that molecule, and then that molecule then goes around and sticks to the ATP in as a chemical reaction. So the ADP is rephosphated to ATP with the phosphocreatine. I can't pronounce it. I've only read it. Phosphocreatine. So this is interesting because, say, if you do something, the ATP will be used up, and then you'll have, if you have this other energy cell, it can instantly recharge. So it's almost like the capacitors on your battery recharges. So your batteries then float around, and they float in, and as soon as they hit this molecule, it gets a phosphate stuck to it. And this molecule then gets back and gets rephosphated. So it's sort of like a very fast, efficient way of regenerating your ATP. So what they can do is they can actually measure movement, the concentration of this phosphocreatine, or creatine, whatever it is, I can't say. And what happens is that in a, when your muscle moves, this this pulls down really quickly and makes the ATP, recharges the ATP almost instantly. So your ATP concentration goes down a little bit and gets recharged a bit. And so this sort of allows the cell to ramp up activity. It's where the energy is stored. The energy is not stored in the ATP because that's, as long as there's ATP, it can run that down. It's sort of like, ATP is sort of like the petrol. Petrol station, the general petrol, and it's not quite like it's this process which allows if I just use ATP, energy of motion, the speed of things would be proportional to the amount of ATP that I have floating around the place. So there's limiting things. But if I then began to decrease my ATP, I'd decrease the activity of what's going on. So as long as I can actually have an excess of the phosphocretin there, so it means that the ATP concentration will stay the same. This other background thing will start to go down. And as it goes down, the cell produces more of it. So it's sort of like an emergency backup energy for cells. So cells can keep on operating at the same amount, but that they have this energy reserve the phosphocretin. Now, this all comes out to seeing it. And phosphorus and fluorine are one of the more freaky elements in that they're monoisotopic. So the hydrogen and helium are one isotope. After that, it's very rare. I don't know if there's any other monoisotopic things. After that, things are of different isotopes. Now, there's this sort of like this. I think this is a fairly interesting aspect that your phosphorus is by far, for me, in terms of nuclear physics, a very interesting thing. So there's only fluorine 19, fluorine 20, and fluorine 18 are radioactive. They, I think fluorine 18, emits a positron, that's used in FET, in a PET. These ones, and phosphorus. Phosphorus, you can get phosphorus, I think, right down into possibly 18. It's got a huge, ridiculous amount of isotopes that you can make. I think it's phosphorus like 43. There's a huge range. There's probably not 15, 14 isotopes all in all, and only one of them is stable. And most a nanosecond or a minute or 3 minute half-life or something like that. So in nature, you've only got phosphorus 31. Now, phosphorus has an even number of protons. I know that because it's under oxygen, and oxygen is 8. So it's it's 8 protons. Oxygen's in the 6th or 16th column of the periodic table. I often do make mistakes when I'm thinking about the periodic table. I often say 108. It's got 118 elements in the periodic table. So the important thing with this is that you would think an even number of anything is always more stable, except for phosphorus. Phosphorus 31 is more stable. So it's just one of those things, the way that the... So if you've got an island of stability up the periodic table, you've got an island of instability around phosphorus. phosphorus nearly is an element which is just in there. Can you imagine that if phosphorus was, you know, like technetium, phosphorus is so essential to life. So you've got oxygen, obviously, and stuff like that, but phosphorus, the chemical reactions involving phosphorus are pretty stunning. So phosphorus is the sort of the thread. Phosphorus is in the thread at the back of DNA. So your coloured teeth, your different bases are there, but your thread is a phosphorus sugar backbone. It's got this beautiful thing of being highly negative and easy to bond. It's sort of idea. This is phosphate. It's a pretty amazing aspect. But the nucleus is 31. Now 31 means that it has an unpaired neutron. So the actual magnetic moment of a phosphorus nucleus is from its unpaired neutron, because it's got paired proteins. So hydrogen is obviously an unpaired proton, but you can have protons and neutrons, so it's got an unpaired neutron, whereas fluorine, F19, is an unpaired unpaired proton. So phosphorus, obviously there's heaps and heaps of phosphorus here, and these protons are in different magnetic fields. So your protein in there's a different magnetic field due to the electrons around it, its electron density surrounding it. So and these are unlike biological samples. These are surrounded. So having an unpaired magnetic moment means that it will gyrate. And the important thing is that this cannot work with the liquid drop molecule. You can't have an unpaired paired neutron looking as it's the only neutron there, because that would be insanely complex. It's actually a quantum mechanical neutron, so it's sitting in the middle of the nucleus. When I say the middle, the dead center, 000. This is persisting. It's got a little more Lamour gyration frequency. It's been around a magnetic field. And so you can ring and do all your magnetic resonance spectroscopy with this and look at it, and this means that you can get a cell and you can actually look at various concentrations of things in the cell. So you can see whether it's acidic, basic, the conditions. So you've got three peaks that you can have in your MRI MR spectrum. You have the phosphocretin peak. So this is rather insulated. The phosphorus is pulled out of solution. It's on this molecule, and this molecule is a single. It doesn't dock with anything except when it's just in exchanging its phosphorus, recharging your ATP. So this chemical peak, there's a large, strong, sharp chemical peak for it. Then you've got your free phosphate molecules, polyatomic molecules, which get chucked out. And these are in the sea, so these have got a broad peak. And the vicinity of this peak can check how much electrons there are in the fluid, free electrons, I suppose you call free electrons, or protons. So if there's protons is like little positive charges, lack of electrons, so you got these little protons going around, so you can actually see that peak move. And similarly, there's a way of seeing the amount of magnesium and other ions in it. And you can see the concentrations of these things. So when you flex your muscle, your ATP drops and increases, and you've also got an ATP peak there. So your ATP flexes, and which is also a broad peak to a certain extent, because ATP, it's got a large molecule associated with it, so it's a large number of interactions it can have with it. So ATP is designed to go into proteins, whereas the phosphocreatine is designed to pick up the phosphate quickly and go to the ATP and recharge it quickly. So it's got a job to do quickly, and then the ATP uses its design. I suppose the interesting thing is that the things which emit the charges are held away from the protein. So you wouldn't get the phosphates getting into the protein, because it would mean the phosphate wouldn't be able to escape from the photo. The phosphates are at the back of it when it goes in to come out. Well, this is when I talk about this. This is the my sort of imagining of it all. So the story of why the nucleus of phosphate is interesting is it's one of these nucleuses. So in general, you have particularly the good nuclei for MRI. Magnetic resonance imaging, you need to have an odd number of nucleons. You've got to have an odd number of nucleons, and an even number, so you're lucky. An odd number of nucleons to have a unpaired spin. You've got your protons and your neutrons to go across it. Now, the magnetic moment of the proton and the neutron are opposite signs. That means that there would be... I wonder how that would go. I really wonder whether that is something... that would be something interesting to... think about. So if you've got that, you can actually measure the not only the amount of phosphorus, but in real time, but you can measure the chemical conditions of it and watch all this happening. Now, I don't know whether this is sort of clinical any use. It's a sort of clinical confirmation that this process happens, and we understand it from MRI stuff. It's sort of like, I suppose, very much the proof of Einstein's general relativity or special relativity by putting atomic clocks in a plane. It's something that is very high profile and use it. So there's these experiments that if you look at what's going on, you can see what's going on, but sort of nowadays, I don't know whether it's diagnostically interesting to put the phosphate in MRI spectroscopy, and whether you can, whether you can get some brain imaging to do it. So one would say that you could perhaps do a phosphate MRI image of the human brain and see how much energy was going on. But there seems so many other high-end ways of getting the image through. So I don't know. There might be a cheaper way of doing a baseline PET scan. You might be able to do a phosphate scan to see the amount of cell energy, but it's trying to pick that up. So a PET scan, you feed fluorine. I think it's fluorine 18. You make oxygen and you knock out a oxygen neutron. You put in a proton. You fire a proton into the nucleus. And conservation momentum, the neutron flies out and the proton sits there. The proton says is really unhappy. It's far more stable there, and so it turns into a neutron. I'm just trying to think. Yeah, the neutron turns. Oh, I'm just trying to. I'm really trying to think of that. I'm a bit confused. I'll have to really think that through. You can see me trying to work through this thing in my head. So that's just a discussion of the phosphate chemistry. It's a very interesting thing to go through, and it's just pointed out to me that I will have to re-memorize and re-look at the PET scan stuff. So you'll see. So you're seeing me do years and years of study. Get it out. Initially, I would just absorb all this information. Now I absorb it and forget bits, and it gets a little bit confused. And it is good in a way, because it means that I, before, when I got something really quickly, I'd often not see the details. Now I'm sort of like this. My strategy is not to have an optimized understanding. It is to efficiently manage the optimizing process of memorizing things. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'm going to read some Chang Zhu later on. Thanks a lot. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.